Welcome to the Principled Podcast, brought to you by LRN. The Principled Podcast brings together the collective wisdom on ethics, business and compliance, transformative stories of leadership, and inspiring workplace culture. Listen in to discover valuable strategies from our community of business leaders and workplace changemakers.
Welcome to Principled. In celebration of our 25th year, we're bringing this podcast series. Today we have Rashmi Aaron joining us. Hello, Rashmi.
Hi there. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. I appreciate you joining us this afternoon. I think our listeners are in for a great experience learning. I've learned so much in getting to know you through various industry events and conferences, and I find your story incredibly compelling and really want to bring it forward here for our listeners. So if you could share just a little bit about your background with our listeners.
Sure. Thank you so much again to Marsha and to LRN for having me. I'm thrilled and honored to be able to share my story with your listeners. So I come from a family of Indian origin, and I grew up in Miami, Florida. And I would say I was that girl growing up trying to be perfect because that's what I thought was expected of me, and I certainly placed that expectation upon myself. I ultimately went to UNC Chapel Hill, spent a little stint on Wall Street, and then I went to Columbia Law School. And at each of those, you know, of course, tried to excel and win all the awards and make those around me proud of me. Ultimately, I opened my own real estate law practice in Miami, Florida, after working at some law firms around the country and also for the government here locally for a little while. So when I opened my own law practice, that was in 2004. A few years later, as I had two little children, I was given the opportunity to meet a real estate developer. Mm-hmm. And at the time, this is in 2007, so if you can kind of take yourself back to the heyday of the real estate boom right before the crisis, I really jumped at this opportunity because I thought if I could get a real estate developer as a client, me, solo practitioner, you know, small little law firm, if I could get a big developer client, that would ultimately mean more financial stability and more time with my kids. Mm-hmm. So I walked into this meeting with the developer with this goal, really, because mm-hmm. I wanted to impress him and I wanted to land him as a client. And I remember feeling very focused on that. So he began to describe these creative transactions that he was doing. And I would say that I used to pride myself and probably continue to do so, but in a different way now. But I used to pride myself on being creative and aggressive and bold and strategic and helping my clients think outside of the box. And I now recognize that at the time I was so focused on getting the client that I didn't allow myself to see these red flags that were going on around me. Ultimately, I ended up working with this developer. Really, within 2 weeks, I started working with him. I recognize now that I did not do any due diligence, and I sort of jumped at the opportunity without dotting all my I's and crossing all my T's. And I did about 100 closings for him in Palm Beach and 100 mm-hmm. in Tampa mm-hmm. and stopped working with him actually in March of 2009. And then in May 2011, I got a visit from the FBI. Mm. And I remember at the time thinking, well, I'm an open book and I haven't done anything wrong, right, so I'm going to talk to them because otherwise, you know, FBI operates off fear, and I certainly thought, my God, if I don't talk to them, they're definitely going to think I did something wrong. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I let them into my office, and two agents came and sat in my little table in my office, and for 4 hours they interrogated me. And, you know, I didn't have my attorney present. I didn't recognize
Well, you didn't know what you didn't know,
I didn't, and mm-hmm. I didn't realize that I could I could say to them, can I please come back to you with my attorney with me. You know, I just didn't realize mm-hmm. I could do any of this. And nobody really tells you in life or law school, actually, unless maybe you've been touched by this or have heard my story, have heard somebody else's story similar to this, to know mm-hmm. that that's a right that we have. Anyways, they interrogated me for 4 hours. They showed me documents and pictures and emails and all sorts of things. And I'm sitting there answering these questions as if I even remembered what happened 4 years earlier, which I didn't. And, you know, not, of course, exactly, because who can remember every person you met and every document you've ever seen and email you've read or forwarded or anything. Mm-hmm. They left, and I just thought it was over. And 2 years then passed, and I didn't think anything
of
it.
Wow, a whole 2 years passed after the interrogation.
2 years, yeah.
Wow,
so then it was June
okay.
2013. So we're talking 6 years
wow.
now after I switched with this developer, and 4 years after I have stopped working with him, mm-hmm. I receive a grand jury subpoena.
Mm.
So the subpoena itself was actually for documents, and I'm still operating under this pretense, like, oh, okay, I'm the records custodian, so they just want my files, and
yeah.
they must be after the developer and the buyers and the brokers and the realtors, but I'm fine. My files
yeah.
are perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't done anything wrong. So I submit all my records, and then within 3 months, my attorney called me in, and my attorney at the time was like a father figure to me. He's a former U.S. attorney of the Southern District of Florida, and you know, was a mentor for years for me. And he called me in. He essentially told me, you're a target.
Wow.
And I mean, now, you know, of course, now I'm on the other side of it and I share my story around the world, but I'm at peace. But then I would literally shake uncontrollably because
yeah.
this was my whole life.
Yeah.
This was everything I had worked my whole life for. All I could think was I'm disgracing my parents and my family and my community and my children. And,
yeah,
you know, it was really, really scary. So ultimately, I was indicted after a process of, you know, kind of getting to where I could own it and recognizing that I did do something wrong. I decided to plead guilty and cooperate with the government and really owned it to my community and was able to thankfully recognize that I had done something wrong and that I had kept silent when I should have been asking questions and that I was ignoring red flags and that there were these blind spots that I didn't even realize made me unaware of these decisions that I was making that were bad. I was then sentenced in June 2016 to a year and a day in prison. I guess fortunate while I was in prison that I was given the opportunity to testify in another case.
Mm-hmm.
So I did spend like 23 days in county jail in Pasco County, Florida, which is St. Petersburg, where I was asked to testify in another case. So because of that, I did get early release.
Mm-hmm.
So I ultimately spent about 6 months in prison, incarcerated. I've now been home almost, well, a little over 3 years now. I had mm-hmm. 3 years of supervised release. And since I've been home, I have been able to share my story and really learn some hard lessons about ethics and compliance and leadership and how it applies to culture. And now I've been sharing my story.
What have you learned, you know, looking back, like if you had to be that coach to yourself, where were the red flags and what would you do differently?
Yeah, those are some great questions. You know, it's interesting because I would say that I was so focused on achieving goals and making people around me proud of me and kind of keeping up appearances, of course. We all get trapped in that race course that we're stuck going around and,
mm-hmm.
you know, trying to get people around us to be impressed with us, right, or proud of us or, you know, live up to appearances. And I was certainly stuck in that. And it's not that I was a bad person. I mean, I certainly think I was a good person. But when you're so focused on the outcomes and the goals, you mm-hmm. lose sight of the process. And as a solo practitioner, I think I was wearing so many hats that I wasn't paying attention to the details. So I remember even walking in, the first moment I met the developers, operations guys, like in the first moment they began to describe these transactions to me, I took a moment and I went into a separate room and I called my underwriting counsel to describe the transactions. And even in that first call,
mm-hmm.
there was a piece of information that I left out. And now I recognize going back, that in the moment, I didn't think it was important, and I sort of rationalized it, that it was not part of the process, it doesn't affect my escrow account, it doesn't affect my settlement statement, it's not part of my specific ins and outs money-wise. But
mm-hmm.
what I recognize now in hindsight is that I didn't ask the hard questions, I didn't share those little bits of detail because I didn't want to get those answers. And you know, you can't just sit blindly. So this idea of motivational blindness and wanting to be kind of quiet or blind to what's going on around you because it just serves to be convenient, so you can keep doing what you're doing or keep the client in this case, that was a huge issue for me. And I didn't even know this idea of motivational blindness or, you know, the outcomes overweighing the process or overconfidence bias. I mean, this idea that I was so confident in me being a good person that it never occurred to me that I should be stopping in every moment and considering the morality of what I was doing. And
mm-hmm.
having that full awareness is something that I think especially young lawyers and young professionals,
mm-hmm.
we kind of convince ourselves that we're invincible as we start out on our professional mm-hmm. trajectories, because you know, maybe we've gone to a good school, or maybe we've been told we're smart or whatever. Mm. We've got great intentions and great goals, and, you know, we're trying to raise families, and we get so caught up in the day-to-day that we don't take the time to pause and reflect. And those are the moments that I recognize now I should have done.
Tell me more about that, you know, kind of in your experience. Did you feel like you were just so focused on the outcome that you couldn't stop and ask the right questions?
Well, yes, for me, especially, you know, I was a solo practitioner. So in my case, there's good and bad that comes along with being your own boss, right? There was nobody to kind of have a checks and balances that I had to report to. But there was also really nobody directly that I could have gone in the day-to-day to ask questions for, who contextually could understand exactly what I was going through. Now, having said that, there were lots of people in my life and my community, including friends and mentors, that all could have helped me and could have given me a second opinion. I just chose not to go to them, probably because I didn't want to know what they were going to say. And again, I didn't want to lose a client. But, you know, there's all other aspects. You know, I do a lot of work now as well, like you, with, you know, leaders and, you know, corporate executives. And one of the biggest things I think that's important in creating this culture of courage and culture of transparency and authenticity is leaders themselves have to make it very clear that they are going to hold themselves accountable. Mm-hmm. And when there's a failure or there's something that's happened, it's up to the leaders to step up, be vulnerable, and have the courage to say, I did this, or we as a team have done this, or this is what the company has done, and step into that really uncomfortable space of having a conversation with your team that recognizes that we didn't do so good here, but how are we going to fix it? Mm-hmm. And let's move on. What are we going to learn from it? Because the reality is, as we all know, you know, we're human beings and we're not meant to be perfect. So yeah, there are going to be things that happen along the way. And, you know, gone are the days where everyone has to be perfect in order to be respected and loved and to progress. I think that the idea of incentivizing ethical decision-making and a speak-up culture are, as you said, are starting to creep into cultures where, you know, leaders are recognizing that there's huge value in not only onboarding employees, you know, with this mentality and, you know, retaining employees in this way, but also incentivizing and giving people bonuses for having made the right decision or having come forward when something was difficult and maybe they didn't necessarily make the right decision, but they've come forward immediately and said, this is, I think I did this. What do I do to fix it? How do we, as a corporation, you know, deal with this crisis or this, you know, risk to our brand or to our reputation? You know, those are things that I think are starting to happen and change within our cultures, which are vital.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think there's also a sense of, as leaders are promoted into roles of management, managing people and teams and parts of the business, one thing that has been missed or that has been overlooked is, are we developing and coaching the next generation of leaders to be more culturally aware and culturally sensitive in terms of how they behave? Are they listening? Are they accessible? Are they available to talk through the situations and the context in which to apply, you know, a lot of the rules? I mean, historically, compliance has been like the guardrails of the business. So it's like, okay, now you know right. What the rules are. Like in your case, for example, share with our listeners, like, so what exactly was the charge that they, you know, like, what did they charge you with?
Sure. So I was indicted for one count of conspiracy to commit bank fraud and then 23 counts of bank fraud, which were 23 individual mm-hmm. transactions that they pulled out from the files. Where the fraud was lack of disclosure to the banks mm-hmm. as to the full scenario. Because what was happening was the creativity that was occurring in these transactions was that the seller was incentivizing buyers to buy condo units in a condo conversion, what was called a rental guarantee. So it was essentially a buyer incentive.
Right.
But many developers are doing, frankly, across the country in many different creative ways. This was one of them.
Creative is the key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but as we know, creativity is good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
And what sometimes can be seen as legal isn't always ethical
right.
and vice versa.
Right.
And so I think that that's also a really important distinction to make. You know, I would say that the new generation of young leaders, you know, and working professionals, I think it crosses sort of the spectrum because, you know, we have, as I can see, just from the people that I'm now working with in these types of training scenarios, there is a growing interest and commitment to getting it right and to really putting forth the right, not just training, but conversation amongst our teams and within our workplaces and, you know, from leaders all the way down to the front line. But there's still an absence and you know, people are making a choice to still ignore the difficulties that exist out there mm-hmm. globally as well.
How are you kind of charting the path forward, and what are some of the kind of objectives you have?
Yeah, thanks. I would say, first of all, I owe it to my family, to my parents, and to my, I think, my role models growing up that I was taught about. So I've got some incredible role models that have taught me to be a survivor and mm-hmm. be resilient. I think resilience is something that comes from within. And I would say for me, it comes from relying on my relationships. You know, that's first and foremost, I think, is obviously I had to forgive myself yeah. and really allow myself the courage to step out of being mad at myself and mm-hmm. how could this have happened to me and how did I let this happen to me and all that stuff. And then rise above that and say, okay, this is something that has happened, but I'm not going to let it define me. And then after I did that, I kind of owned it to everybody. I've called over 300 people wow. in my life, people I hadn't spoken to for 20, 30 years even, and even my kids' friends' parents and my kids' teachers. I mean, I just called everybody, and it was really important for me to own it, and it was very healing for me, but mm-hmm. I think that also gained me unconditional love and support. Mm-hmm. And that connection was really powerful for me to allow me to believe in myself and to move forward. So I think that's a huge part of it.
I really appreciate you taking the time to share more about your journey with our listeners. And for everyone listening, I really think that Rashmi is one to watch. I can't wait to see some of the great areas of impact you will chart forward. And I appreciate you joining us here on Principled.
Sure. Thank you so much, Marcia and LRN.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. The Principled Podcast is brought to you by LRN. At LRN, our mission is to inspire principled performance in global organizations by helping them foster winning, ethical cultures rooted in sustainable values. Please visit us at LRN.com to learn more. And if you enjoyed this episode, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to leave us a review.